Okay, let's get started. Are there any questions before we start the discussion? So there were answers that, some of the people who put up answers for these, just in case other people are interested. Of course, the best learner, the worst learner is a 50% accuracy learner on a two-class classification problem, because if it's more, it's good. If it is less, you just take the negation of that, and that will be a better learner, okay? Regarding the training examples, one of the problems is if you fit your learner to work extremely well on the training examples, you will do well on the training examples, but you may not do well on the test examples. And in fact, there is some beautiful theory which sort of shows, for example, let me see, yeah. So for example, if you consider, let's say, if you're thinking, in the context of learning, let's say these are all the positives, these are all the negatives, and you're trying to find a classifier. One way of thinking about a classifier is, a function which on one side of the function is all the positives, other side is all the negatives, okay? And, given this particular set of examples, you can look for a line which basically, unfortunately, there is no best line in this particular case. This line has most of the positives on this side, but a few positives on the other side. And then R, you can take a curve, in which case essentially it has less error, but it still has some positives on the other side. Okay. And then finally, you can look for a function like that, which essentially exactly fits to the training data, such that on the training data, you are 100% correct on the positives and negatives, okay? The problem, if you compare their error in the context of the training data, error is coming down. So this is the, somewhere here on the x-axis is this, then this is somewhere here, this is somewhere there. So the training data error is coming down completely, okay? And yet, what matters is the error on the test data. Learning is all about testing, the future, not about the past, okay? And so what happens, in fact, is if you consider the test data error, the test data error actually comes down in the beginning, but then it starts going up. And this is exactly what's called the overfitting problem. So if you pay too much attention to everything that the teacher says, then you not only get the insights of the teacher, but also all the tics of the teacher. And that may not be good. Okay. So that's the whole point of, question there, if there is noise in the data, if there is noise in the classification, that's a scenario where this actually winds up being an important issue. If you fit too much to the training data, you may actually be worse on the test data, which is possible. Okay. The other thing, of course, it's connected to question one, is compression. Learning and compression are very closely related, except the main difference is compression is about past and learning is about future. Okay. When you compress, you would be interested, for example, in lossless compression. Okay, if you want to do lossless compression, in that previous picture, that the most complex function is the lossless compression of the data, because that would be correctly predicting positives and negatives. Okay, but lossless compression might wind up actually being more error prone on the test data. Okay, so that's the important difference between compression and learning, and so you should keep that in mind. As far as human learning and biases are concerned, you can think of prior knowledge essentially as a form of bias, in the sense that it does reduce, it does basically make certain hypotheses more likely than other hypotheses. So to the extent you believe that the planetary system has Earth in the middle and you know everything revolving around it, and then if you observe some phenomenon and you're trying to figure out how to explain it, you're more likely to you know prefer hypotheses that are consistent with your prior knowledge. Okay, so you can think of prior knowledge as biasing your hypothesis. Okay, and then this I'll go more into detail in the first slide, in the first topic of the discussion in today, which is really how do you go about you know testing a learner, how can you set up a fair test, and we'll talk about that in more detail in you know in a minute. Okay, so so a couple of questions before we start. One is the final exam. I have some options for you, and you know whoever is here gets to vote, and then I have my own biases. So one option is to take home that would be given on oh, this has become approximate. That's not good. That basically means I need to do something. Okay. We'll see. One option is to have the exam be given to you on right after the reading day, and then it will be due on 10th, around 10th. Okay, so you do it at home. Okay, that 1/4 is a problem. I'll get rid of that because I think I'm using Tech Point fonts. The other is there's an in-class exam on 10th. There is an actual time for that. Okay. And then, of course, I had thought the option 3 would make sense for everybody concerned, but I think there are problems with that. So you only really have option 1 and 2. So which one do you? How many are in favor of option 1? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14. Okay, how many are in favor of option 2? 1, 2, 3. Okay, so option 1 is the hands down winner right now. Okay, so you will get a take home. I actually prefer, if I had a vote, I would have preferred option 2 in class exam because they're much easier to grade. Because my normal tagline is that empty sheets are easier to grade than sheets with writing on them. Okay, and in class exams are full of beautiful white sheets, and so I really like them, but you know. Since certain people want to have to put up a fight, I guess they get to. Okay, let me see if in fact my next slides are coming fine. No, it's not. So let me give me a second. I need to re-upload. Unfortunately, I need to re-upload Tech Point. If you have any questions while we are going on this, you can. Yeah, Windows, Tech Point for Windows. Let's see. Office 2000. Is this 2007 or 2003? 2003. So. What I want you to start thinking about as I just get this downloaded is the question of there you go, see? That's the good part. So now actually you'll see that the previous slide was approximately equal. It was not 1/4. It's just that they don't believe that we get to download anything onto the machine. So every time I come, I have to re-download TechPoint font. Okay. So the first question that this is actually sort of, you can think of this as the answer to the fourth question in the blog topics, which is, what's the reasonable goal in designing a learner? I mean, how do you even do learning as an algorithm? Okay, because all this while until now, you have thought of algorithms which provide correct answers. Okay, all the time, that's it. And then the question, of course, is get to the correct answers fast. Okay, now the problem is learning changes everything, because first of all, the ideal learner is must be able to classify all new instances, test cases, correctly always, even for just inductive learning, which is this, you know, I give you a bunch of training cases, let's say two class classification, where some are positive, some are negative. I showed you some training cases, and then you learn something, and then when I give you test, you should be able to classify all the test cases correctly all the time. That's the ideal, right? Clearly it doesn't make sense. So the question is, am I really sure that any test cases, can I not set up a test such that you would fail? Of course, yes. Okay, that was the whole point of asking you, how do you decide that an exam is fair? And then the fairness, and fair as well as not dull. Okay, it'll be extremely dull if in fact the exam basically winds up asking the same exact questions as there are on the homework. Right? I mean, I know that you don't agree with me, but it would really be dull, believe me. So the exam has to test on something other than just what you have seen, because otherwise then you may as well have just stored the previous test cases and use a database to retrieve them. Okay? So you have this tension between dullness of the test set versus unfairness of the test set. What if you wound up picking the test cases from a completely different part of the example space? Okay, so to deal with that, we basically make a very important assumption that learning is possible only if test cases are drawn from the same distribution as the training cases. And this is a very general constraint. So the idea is, think of whatever is the universe of examples. Here is the universe of examples. Some are positives and some are negatives. Okay. If it is, you know, two class problem. Some are positive, some are negative. Okay. And the question is, you picked training examples from this universe. And you're also going to pick test examples from this universe. The only requirement is that if you have used a probability distribution function P to pick the training examples, you should use the same probability distribution function to pick the test examples too. That's it. Okay? That's the requirement. As long as the distribution is the same, it's a fair test. Okay? And it turns out that captures most of our intuition as to when is it a fair test. Okay? So the next question, of course, is, did I really mean always? Should the learning be always correct? Not really, even because, in fact, after all, if I, you know, I could be some training examples, I might actually wind up making mistakes, even in the test, you know, test cases. Because given the distribution, probabilistically, it may well be that there are some very unlikely examples that I never picked up during the training, but just because of chance, I wound up picking them up in the test. And so you wouldn't know how to classify them from the training examples. Okay, so there is a possibility that you would only, you would sometimes make mistakes. Okay, and similarly, not about always and also about correctly. Do you mean always should everything be done correctly? Okay, and we essentially say no, it's probably approximately correct. Okay, so the way we'll actually talk about learning algorithms and their performance is, the goal of the learner then is to produce a probably approximately correct hypothesis. And if this doesn't sound wishy-washy, I don't know what sounds wishy-washy, but probably approximately correct is some of the most formal descriptions of machine learning algorithms. In fact, in a minute, we will see that we can compute bounds as to how many examples would you need to actually learn a concept probably approximately correctly. That's the beauty of it. Okay. So this is called pack learning, probably approximately correct. And in fact, we are kidding ourselves when we think that, you know, computer programs can be correct. You know, all programs are abstractions of some real world problem. In fact, all you can say is that when you really truly design an algorithm, it will be doing probably approximately correct thing. Okay, so this really is the more general view of algorithm design. And it, of course, it becomes very much required even in abstract sense for machine learning. Okay, so probably approximately correct learning will basically do with an error rate epsilon and a probability delta. That means, so basic idea is if you have to make 15 tests for this algorithm, okay, in each test there are 10 questions. And, you know, if it has epsilon error rate, that means it can make epsilon of those 10 questions, epsilon percent of those 10 questions, it gets it wrong. Okay, but sometimes it can get more than epsilon percent, sometimes it can get less than epsilon percent. All I am saying is of the 15 tests, delta percent of the test is the only, less than delta percent of the test, would it be having error greater than epsilon? Less than delta percent of the test, it will have error greater than epsilon. Okay, that's what probably approximately correct means. Are there any questions? This is basically what, you know, this is the best way you can understand machine learning algorithms. Before you even get into specifics, this is what you're trying to ensure. Given an error rate bound epsilon and a probability delta, okay, an algorithm is probably approximately correct with epsilon delta. If it makes, in less than delta fraction of the cases, it makes error more than epsilon. Okay, now one way of thinking about it is, what is the epsilon and delta for normal algorithms? What's the epsilon and delta for normal algorithms? For example, if you give a quicksort algorithm, it's probably approximately correct, obviously. But what is the epsilon and delta? Zero and zero. Okay, because it's always correct, and, you know, it's always making 0% of the error in all the cases. Okay, so this is obviously more general notion of correctness. Now, when do you say a learner A is better than learner B? Now you can actually formally answer that question. You would say a learner A is better than learner B if, for the same epsilon delta bound, learner A requires fewer training examples to reach that than learner B. Okay? So this is basically, we talked about this learning curve last time, and in essence what they're trying to answer is, given epsilon delta bounds that you are happy with, which learner is able to reach that with fewer examples? Yes? That's the question. I mean, so the thing is, if you don't mind making mistakes, then you can have high epsilons and deltas. If you want higher and higher accuracy, you have smaller and smaller epsilon and deltas. The only thing is, learning is actually impossible if, you know, in most cases, if epsilon and delta are zeros. So it's just not possible at all. Whereas quicksort is possible. And in fact, one of the interesting things is, I can write approximate sorting algorithms, which would be approximately sorting. And don't laugh, because there may be situations where you want approximate sortedness, much faster. Okay? So the thing is that the question, of course, having figured this out, the only thing that matters really is, how many examples did you need to get to this bound? How many examples did you need to get to this bound? Okay? And there is a beautiful formula here, which I'll actually get you through in the next slide. Okay, it's not all that hard to understand. And that actually uses this point of test cases being drawn from the same distribution as the training cases. Okay, all this says is, the number of examples that you need to probably approximately learn a concept will be greater than 1 over epsilon times log of 1 over delta plus log of h, where h is the size of the hypothesis space. Remember last time we were talking about the number of hypotheses? So the H is the size of the hypothesis space. Okay? And what that basically means is that if in fact you're trying to learn, for example, a concept from all Boolean functions, then you know that H would be 2^2n, where n is the number of Boolean attributes. And so you know that the number of examples you would need would be exponential in the number of attributes, because log of 2^2n is still exponential. Okay? Whereas if you are learning conjunctive functions, conjunctive Boolean functions, the number of examples you would need only will be polynomial, because the number of hypotheses is 3^n and log of 3^n is polynomial in n. Now, of course, you do know that the number of examples you need will increase if you make more and more stronger requirements on the, you know, correctness, the error rate, as well as the percentage of tests where you'll, you know, ensure that your error is less than that. Okay, so it's not at all surprising that n increases if you reduce epsilon or reduce delta. This is not surprising for you. What should be surprising is it's connected to the hypothesis space. Because the bigger the possibility, the bigger the space of hypothesis, the more examples you need to figure out which is the best fitting hypothesis. Okay? Now, yes. No, basically this is the epsilon delta rate. So you're saying in the so think of test cases as there are you're basically giving, you know, 100 tests. Okay? Each test has 100 problems. Okay? Epsilon basically is the error. So the error that you make on a test is the number of problems you got wrong. Okay? Suppose I put epsilon to be, I want an epsilon bound of 0.1, that means I shouldn't be making more than 10 errors on my exam. Okay? Every exam where I make more than 10 errors, that would be a bad exam. Okay? So suppose of the 100 tests, I make, you know, in 25 of the tests, I made more than 10 errors. Then delta essentially is the number of exams that I failed. Okay? And so basically what I can guarantee in this case is delta is 0.25. But if my delta was less than 0.25, then I actually failed to learn with that epsilon and delta. Yes? No, you decide. The point that I'm trying to say is, given the epsilon and delta as part of the input specification, you can design a learning algorithm which will reach, you know, it, which will basically ensure that its learned concept is correct, probably approximately correct with this epsilon and delta. Yes? What? No, because delta is the number of if you reduce delta, if you increase delta, the number of examples you need will be reducing here, right? Because, you know, 1 over delta is this. I mean, if you look at this, okay. Again, I think the important point is that epsilon and delta are, epsilon is the error that you're getting on the number of, you know, number of problems in each test suite. And the delta is number of tests you failed. Delta is talking about the number of tests you failed. Okay? So, this actually, let me see if I can get you through this. It's useful to understand, first of all, that this actually is not coming out of nowhere. It's very easy to compute this bound, okay? And then also it tells you how the the distribution requirement, that the test cases and the training cases are from the same distribution, is actually being used. Okay. To understand this, so the idea, what I'm trying to do is compute this bound, that the number of, what are the number of training examples that would be required to reach a certain epsilon delta bounds. Okay. The idea that I have is I want to compute the probability that a bad hypothesis that actually is going to make more than epsilon error, okay, will wind up being chosen as the answer because it's actually consistent with all the training examples. Okay, remember that the way you pick hypothesis is you compare hypothesis. Remember the last class we talked about how we will compare hypothesis. Let me see, is that the one? No, no. Where are we? Yeah, this slide. We compared hypothesis in terms of their false positives and false negatives. So one simple thing you can do is, you know, you'll only consider hypotheses that don't make any error on the training test, training set, let's say. So the worry is, in terms of learning, the worry is that an actually bad hypothesis, that is a hypothesis that's really going to make mistakes in the test cases, winds up being consistent with the training cases. So you by mistake pick it, and so you lose. Okay? Now what I will try to do is compute the probability that this will happen and bound it by using the delta. And that's all I need to do. Okay? So it turns out that, so probability that, so here is the space of hypothesis. This is the space of hypothesis. And each hypothesis from this space can be seen as splitting the examples in the universe of examples into positives and negatives. Each hypothesis splits them into positives and negatives. Okay. Now, a hypothesis is bad if in fact it does more than epsilon percent of error in splitting them. Okay. Now the worry is, assume that, so let's say there is a bunch of, so there is the function that I'm trying to teach you is this, and there is a small neighborhood around that function, that particular hypothesis, which also make about the same percentage of error, less than epsilon percent of error. Okay. But then most of the other hypotheses make more than epsilon error. Okay. So all I start with is the probability that any of the hypotheses here, the probability that they will misclassify an instance from the universe is greater than epsilon. That's all I know. That's a bad hypothesis. If it was going to misclassify an instance with greater than epsilon probability, now the probability that it winds up being consistent with a single training example is less than 1 minus epsilon, because the training examples are from the same distribution as the test examples. Okay, training examples are the same, from the same distribution as test examples. So if it was going to make greater than epsilon error on the test cases, then it the probability that it is actually consistent with a single training case is 1 minus epsilon. And so the probability that it is consistent, and so this is the point, I mean, this business of less than 1 minus epsilon, you can say this only because test and training cases are from the same distribution. That's all. I don't need to know what distribution it is. All I need to know is that they're from the same distribution. Once I have used that, the next question is, it's now consistent with all n examples, all n training examples. So it's basically assuming that the training examples are being drawn independently, then the probability that it is consistent with all n training examples is less than 1 minus epsilon power n. Okay? That is the probability that this single bad hypothesis wound up being consistent with all training cases. Now there actually are h bad, number of bad hypotheses. Any of them, if they do this, they can get picked up. Okay, so the probability that some bad hypothesis winds up being consistent with all the training cases. So again, the reasoning behind this also gives you understanding of what is a learning algorithm trying to do. The learners are always worried that something that's actually going to make me flunk in the exam is going to be consistent with my understanding of the homework. Okay, that's when problems happen. Okay, so the probability that a some single bad hypothesis will be consistent with all the training examples is H bad size times 1 minus epsilon power n. Okay? And that H bad is all, now that this quantity of course is going to be less than H times 1 minus epsilon power n because H bad is smaller than H. How much smaller? I don't care, it's smaller. Okay? So now I have a nice count quantity, which is this is the probability that some hypothesis which is actually bad, in the sense it's going to make more than epsilon error on the test cases, is going to get picked up. I want to reduce that probability. So what I do is I will make that to be less than or equal to delta. Okay? And if I make that less than or equal to delta, and then I use a little inequality basically saying e power minus epsilon is greater than 1 minus epsilon, you can then convert that into that expression, which essentially says, it got, okay. So that expression, which basically says that n is greater than or equal to 1 over epsilon times log of 1 over delta plus log of h. Okay. So this is what we were talking about earlier. Okay. So you can actually, at least in this one simple case, you can derive bounds on the number of examples needed to learn a concept probably approximately correct. Okay. And then you would say that a learning problem is intractable if in fact the number of examples needed to learn it is exponential in the space of attributes, number of attributes. Okay, so the easy to learn in Boolean space, easy to learn problems are conjunctive functions, disjunctive Boolean functions, as well as length limited Boolean functions. Okay, whereas hard to learn ones are things like the full set of Boolean functions, because that's 2 power 2 power n. Of course, it turns out that this analysis only works for discrete cases. Okay? It turns out that a equivalent idea also exists for continuous case, and such that there is actually a general theory of which this is a specialization. Okay? So obviously you can't directly use this for, you know, continuous cases. Let's say where a continuous case where you're considering all possible lines separating pluses and minuses. There are infinite number of them. Okay, in that case, there is a different way of doing this analysis, but it's still useful to understand this. Okay, so the interesting point again is that learning is actually possible only because we make assumptions about the test case, training case distribution, and we also are willing to take errors in classification. Okay. Now, last class we talked about the fact that if you're actually talking about practical learning algorithms, you need to decide what is the hypothesis space looking like, okay? And the hypothesis space could be hypothesis space of decision trees, linear threshold units, Bayes networks, association rules, any of these. So what I'll try to do now is try to get you an idea of two of them, how to learn the decision trees and how to learn perceptrons, which are simple type of linear threshold unit. Okay, so for the decision trees, again, if I give you the space of hypothesis, all you really need to do is loop through all the hypotheses, rank each hypothesis in terms of its match to data, and pick the one that matches maximally. Now, if I give you decision trees, then the question, of course, is how many decision trees are there? If there are n Boolean attributes, how many decision trees are there? It turns out there are as many decision trees as there are Boolean functions, because every Boolean function can be represented as a decision tree. Okay? So in fact, in this case, the way, if you wanted to go through all the decision trees, then obviously it's going to take a whole bunch of time. So you're going to go through 2 power n decision trees. Okay? So obviously you have to search through this. Normally what you do is you reduce the size of the hypothesis space. In this case, decision trees don't reduce the size of the hypothesis space. It's still 2 power 2 power n. Another way you can reduce it is to have a bias on the type of decision trees you're preferring. There's something called a preference bias. So for example, I would say, get me the smallest decision tree that is consistent with the example. So if there are multiple decision trees that are consistent with the examples, training examples, then I pick the one that's smaller. Okay. Having said this, one idea I can do, of course, is to go for search, how to search the space of hypotheses with this bias. And we will look at, I mean, it can actually be using any of the search techniques that we have learned in the class. Okay. First, we will actually look at, for decision tree learners, the normal idea is to use a greedy search. And greedy search doesn't give you the optimal decision tree all the time. It doesn't necessarily give the smallest decision tree all the time, but it will get you pretty good performance most of the time. Okay, so there's an example of greedy search. And then when we look at linear threshold units, we will see that the search there, because it's a continuous space, the search that we do there is the iterative gradient descent search. Okay, which is also a greedy search except in the continuous space. That of course brings up the question, will you ever do systematic search to look for the best hypothesis? It turns out you do systematic search, although I won't give you examples in this class. For example, there is this whole idea called version space learning, which essentially systematically considers the entire space of hypotheses and keeps making the window of consistent hypotheses narrower and narrower and narrower until it is left with the set of hypotheses that are all consistent. And it says, now pick from any of these. That's a systematic search. Okay. Another different idea, of course, is if you are in the continuous space and you want to do systematic search, normally you would be doing optimization. So for example, you know, I have get me, for example, something like an integer programming formulation, which says, given the following constraints, optimize this particular objective function. I can do systematic search for that. Okay. And it turns out that in trying to figure out the best hypothesis that has some, let's say, the smallest length as well as being most consistent with the example, you will wind up having to do optimization search. Okay. And I'll briefly mention this whole idea called support vector machines, which are in a generalization of linear threshold units based learning, which can be seen as doing quadratic programming, which is integer programming, but I mean it's a mathematical programming technique where the optimization function is quadratic rather than linear. Okay, so the reason I'm bringing this up is learning ultimately winds up using all kinds of search. Some learners use greedy search, some use iterative descent search, some might be using systematic search. Okay, the two that we see first are greedy search. The decision trees will use greedy search. And you know, neural networks, perceptrons use iterative the gradient descent search. But then there are other kinds of learners which use actual optimization search. Okay. So coming back to the decision trees, so what I want to do is, you know, remember again, my example is this Russell restaurant scenario, and the question I have is. Given an example, which is let's see, where is my example? Okay, which is defined in terms of all these attributes, I need to say whether Russell will wait for to be seated or not wait to be seated. Okay, so here is an example of a decision tree. I mean, I'm assuming you sort of know what decision trees are, but if not, a decision tree is 20 questions, AI style. Okay. So first you, in this case, given a test example, I ask how many patterns are there. And if you say none, I will say the answer right away. No, Russell won't wait. Some, I'll say yes, Russell will wait. Full, then I'll ask you some more questions. Okay. If it's full, then I can ask some more questions. So in this case, is the wait estimate more than 60, less, you know, 30 to 60 minutes, 10 to 30, etc., etc. So the interesting question is, a decision tree is a strategy for asking 20 questions, and the smallest decision tree would be the optimal strategy. Okay, so for example, you could have a different decision tree, which also separates the examples, but it winds up asking questions in the completely opposite way. Okay. So the real question, of course, is can you get the smaller decision tree? Okay. And so in terms of making the decision tree consistent with the examples in a greedy fashion, the idea is very simple. If you're doing it greedily, pick an attribute, split the examples in terms of that attribute. Okay. Splitting the examples in terms of an attribute is, if I pick patterns, it can only have values none, some, and full. And you consider all the training examples which have patterns equal to none, that is this set. All the training examples with patterns equal to some, that will be this set, and so on. And then, so let me just actually show you that example. So here's patterns, and here is the original set of examples. There are a bunch of positives and bunch of negatives. So positives are all the ones where Russell was waiting for to be seated. Negatives are the ones where he decided not to wait. Now, if I were to ask the question on patterns, then patterns none, there are no positive examples, only negative examples. Patterns sum, there are only positive examples, no negative examples. Patterns full, there are some positives and some negatives. Okay, at this point, what I can do then is if I decide to pick patterns as my first question, right, then I would say in this, if this is the answer, then I will assume that Russell will not wait because none of the training examples he waited. And this one, I will assume Russell will wait because none of the training examples he's not waiting. That's, are all the training examples he winds up waiting. And in this one, I have two options. One is I'll say enough is enough. I'm just going to, you know, go with the majority. So in this case, Russell is more likely to leave than wait. But if I say no, you know, take some more time and try to give the answer, then I will say, well, I want to ask another question. So I will start from this point and recursively do the same thing that I did from there. Okay, starting from here, decide which of the next attributes should I ask a question on. Okay, so in terms of the algorithm itself, you pick an attribute, split the examples in terms of that attribute. If all the examples are positive, label yes. If all are negative, label no and terminate. If some are positive, some are negative, either continue splitting recursively, or if you want a full decision tree, you will continue splitting recursively. Okay? Or you can say, I will stop and take the majority as the label. Okay? So in this particular case, the majority here is negative, so I'll just take negative as the label. If you go with a decision tree normally, that means the decision tree at least completely classified all the training examples correctly. If you stop with something like this, then you say it's a decision stump. Okay? And in fact, there are very interesting reasons why sometimes you must stop with a decision stump rather than decision tree. Okay? Imagine the following scenario where is the exact same examples on Russell waiting, okay? Except actually the examples here, all of these are defined, and the answer here, the concept here is, what did the coin come up, heads or tails? So Russell basically, you know, wears red clothes on a Tuesday, wears wingtip shoes, and takes a coin and tosses it. And it comes heads or tails. And next day he wears a different day, he wears different shoes, different hairdo, everything, again takes a coin and tosses it. It comes a heads or tails. Okay. Now, if I give you a bunch of training examples of that kind, you can, by asking questions, if the number of training examples is small enough and number of attributes is large enough, you can, by asking a reasonable number of questions, you can completely correctly classify the training examples. Essentially, what it does is it has compressed the training examples. It says, if it was Tuesday and Russell was wearing V2 shoes and he has the following hairdo, then the coin will come heads. That's totally bogus. It just came heads in the training cases. It's never going to come heads all the time. Okay? So, in that kind of a scenario, your best strategy would have been to stop splitting after a while. Your best strategy would have been to stop splitting after a while and say, I will go with the decision stump. Okay? But that's actually a second order problem. Right now, we'll assume that, you know, we are looking for the complete decision trees. Okay? So, the question is, the entire thing about understanding this little greedy algorithm is, which attribute do I pick next? That's it. Because once I know which attribute to pick, then I can go through this. Okay? I'll assume that I never come out with a decision stump, so I'll keep splitting until there are questions I can ask. And if no more questions can be asked in a particular branch, that means you asked on every attribute and still you could not come up with all positives or all negatives, that means the data is noisy. That means there are two examples which are identically described in terms of the attributes, but one of them is positive, one of them is negative. In that case, obviously the examples are noisy, or the description is incomplete. That means there are some other attributes that must have been important. So in that case, then you would just go with label of the majority element. Okay? Now the question, of course, is which attribute do I split on? In this case, suppose I can ask patterns as the first question, or type as the first question. If I ask patterns as the first question, this is how the data splits out. Okay. If I ask type as the first question, this is how the data splits out. Which one would you rather pick? If it's just left to you, you didn't know anything about AI or anything. You know how to do 20 questions, right? Which would you pick?
Patterns.
Why? Because after asking the question patterns, in two of the cases, you're done. And there's only one case left where you still have to figure out. So in some sense, what I'm trying to say here is, before asking any questions, if I have to randomly pick if I pick a random example from this set, and I have to guess its class, okay? Or at least in particular, if I'm here and I have these number of positives and these number of negatives, and somebody says, I picked up a random example, and somebody says, I'm going to sell you information about whether the example you have in your hand is positive or negative. The question is, how much money am I willing to pay them? How much information is there in the answer? Okay? In this case, obviously, it's very highly informative, because half of the examples are positive, half are negative. So it's most likely you have no clue whether it's positive or negative, so you want to pay a lot for the information. After you split, here the information is zero, because you know everything is negative. Here also information is zero. And here the information content is more likely to be negative than positive. Okay. Now the information content before versus after is what you're comparing. Okay. The difference between the information content here to here is the information gain. That is the amount of information you gain just because you ask this question. And if the gain is high, you want to pick that feature. So the basic point we try to make is, I want to convert this intuition you have, which is patterns is better than type, into some sort of a numerical formula, which can say patterns has this much gain and type has this much gain, so that I'll say this is bigger than this, so I pick patterns. That's all I want to do. And to do that, you basically go with information content. Okay. So in this case, again, suppose you agree to pick a pattern, so then you will put patterns as part of the tree, and then so you greedily decide that a pattern would be the first question. And then I will decide what to ask as the next question. So starting from here, this and this, I don't need to ask any questions anymore. And starting from here, I need to consider recursively doing addition tree for each of those pieces. Okay. So the information gain idea is the following. Whatever I said earlier, I'm just going to put it in numbers. And so the idea is that there is this idea called entropy of a set of events. Okay. If I have k events, E1 to EK, that occur with probabilities P1 to PK, then I would say that the information content, or the entropy of this event system, one of these events is going to happen, E1 to EK. Okay. E1 is likely to occur with probability P1, E2 with probability P2, EK with probability PK. The information content is essentially given as a summation of minus PI log PI. Okay. The reason this makes sense, first of all, you have to understand there are formal ways of actually getting to this formula. That's not needed for today's class. But you should at least understand that if I have just two events, E1 and E2, right? then basically if this occurs with probability pi, this occurs with probability 1 minus pi. Okay, now the entropy of this system would be sigma pi e1 pi e1 plus 1 minus pi e2. Minus pi log pi plus minus 1 minus pi log 1 minus pi. Okay, the question is, how does that quantity look like? If you were to plot that quantity with respect to pi, pi goes from 0 to 1. How does that quantity look like? If pi is 0, what happens? If pi is 0, E1 never occurs, E2 only occurs. Is it worth telling you information about whether E2 occurs or not? My example for this is, I start a weather bureau in Phoenix in the middle of summer, and I tell you whether or not tomorrow it's going to be hot, and you're going to come and pay me information, pay me money to find out whether it's going to happen or not, whether it's going to be hot tomorrow, whether the sun comes up tomorrow. If I start this weather bureau in Phoenix, nobody is going to pay me any money, okay? Because most of the time, sun is up, it's hot in summer, okay? So that means sun coming up is close to 1, and sun not coming up is close to 0. If I start the same weather bureau in Chirapunji, which is considered the wettest place on earth, okay, again, I lose my business, because most of the day, sun doesn't come up there, because every day it's raining, okay? And so nobody again pays me any money. It's like this time sun coming up is 0, sun not coming up is 1. So what is the best place to start my weather bureau? Where is that? Of the place, and this is a geography B now. It's been said that in London, if you don't like the weather, wait for 1 hour, it will change. Okay, well, London is known to be, you know, pretty hard to predict in terms of whether sun is going to be up or down in any given day. Okay, and so if I want, I should start my weather bureau in London, because there is actually close to half probability of sun not being there and half probability of sun being there at any given time. So people are willing to pay me good money. For things that are foregone conclusions, people aren't going to pay me any money. Okay, so the entropy in this case would sort of look like this. It's highest at 0.5. Okay. And at 0.5, this quantity will be 1. That's the place where you need the information. Okay? So it makes sense. All that this is saying is defining information content this way does make sense, because with low probability, if there is one event is very low probability, one is very high probability, you pretty much know that the second one will occur. And it's opposite, you know that the first one will occur. If it's middle, then you really don't know. Okay? And so I define this, and then, suppose there are, in the training cases, I have n plus positive examples and n minus negative examples. N of plus is the positive examples, n of minus is the negative examples. Then the information content is basically given as, so the probability that a random example is positive is n plus by n plus plus n minus. Probability that the random example is negative is n minus by n plus plus n minus. And the information content then, which is this, I call this I of p plus p minus, just to make my life simple as notation, it will be minus of p plus log p plus minus of p minus log p minus. In fact, p plus and p minus have the relation that they add up to 1. Okay. So, before I split anything, I already know how much information is needed to guess the label of a random element. If all my training examples are positive, by this definition, I should assume that everything that will ever come will also be positive. So suppose I gave you a bunch of true-false questions to train on, and all of them have answers true, then you should assume that most of the exam, the answer would be true. You know, because if you just go with nothing else other than just the description, right? However, if the half are positive, half are negative, you actually have to learn why are some of them positive, some are negative. Okay. Now, having split it on some feature fk, then I would get n1 plus, suppose fk has nk different values, I mean 1 to k different values. Okay, fk has value 1, value 2, etc., value k, and in this branch are all the examples that fk has value 1, and there are n1 plus of them and n1 minus of them, yeah, and so on, n2 plus, n2 minus, nk plus, nk minus. Okay, so then for each of these, if I am in this, I have the information content this and this. Now the question is, what's the probability that I will be in this branch to begin with? If the total number of examples are m plus and n minus, and the total number of examples having this value is n1 plus and n1 minus, then n1 plus n1 minus by n plus n minus is the probability that you come this side. So to get the information content of this, all I do is ni plus ni minus by n plus n minus, which is the probability that you will take that branch, times the information content of that branch. Sum it up.
Will you do an example with?
Yes, I'm going to read next. Yeah. But by the way, this is A, we'll do an example, or B, you will be made to do an example too. Even though I won't grade it, it'll give you a homework thing. But it's actually one of the easiest learning algorithms. All you need is, plugging in numbers. Okay. Understand the intuition first, which is, this is the total information content here, this is the total information content before asking the question. So the difference is what you gained. And the higher the difference, the better the feature. And since this hasn't changed, so if I'm considering fk here and I want to do the same thing for fj, and for both fk and fj, this part would be the same. This would change. So to increase the information gain, I can also just consider whichever has the lowest information required, which is equal to. Okay, here is an example, a simple example in this case, very simple. So I have decided to consider a bunch of cases, training cases of people who, whether or not they hate exams. That's the concept. Okay. And each student is being defined in terms of three attributes, Boolean attributes: masochistic, anxious, and nerdy. Okay. And my examples tell me that first student who is not masochistic, who is anxious, who is not nerdy, but he or she seems to hate exams, and so on. Okay. These are my training examples. My question is, given a random student, how do I predict whether they like exams or not? Okay. So I need to make a decision tree. The decision tree has to start by asking for this random student, either, for example, is this student masochistic? Is this student anxious? Is this student nerdy? The worst you can do is ask all the questions. The best you can do is not ask any questions and say everybody hates exams. If you're right, of course, you'll win. Okay? The most reasonable thing to do is to ask the question that has the highest information gain. Okay? So let me ask, let me consider the idea of splitting these four examples on masochistic, anxious, and nerdy. And if I split, how much information would I need after the split to guess whether a random example is going to be hating or not hating the exam? Okay? And doing that exact thing that we did in the last slide, masochistic, basically, you can be either true, you're masochistic true, which is these two, in which case one of them you hate, one of them you don't hate, and you are not masochistic, one of them you hate, one of them you don't hate. You can really see by this time that actually masochistic is not a good question to ask, right? Because whether or not you're masochistic, the probability that you'd hate the exam you still have, which was the same as before. But if you go through the motions of our nice formula that we set up, it would basically say 2 by 4, because there are two examples in which masochistic is true out of the four examples, times information content of half-half. Because half of those two examples, it's yes, half of those two examples, it's no. Okay? And I half-half will always be 1, because that's the maximum. Okay? And then similarly, 2 by 4, I half-half. Okay? Because that's the other side. Now the interesting thing, of course, is that after you add these up, it will be 1, which basically is saying that asking the question as to whether the student is masochistic is useless, because your chance of guessing whether they are anxious, whether they hate exams or not, is the same before as after. You do the same thing for anxious, whether or not they're anxious. So anxious, true here, in both cases they seem to, the answer for hating exams is yes. Okay? And false, false, in both cases, no. So now what happens? So the information required after splitting on A, anxious, is 2 by 4 I of 1, 0 plus 2 by 4 I of 0, 1. And 1, 0 and 0, 1 are both zeros. So this whole thing will turn out to be 0. So after splitting on anxious, you don't need any more information to guess the label of the training example. That's what this is saying. Okay? So if you consider the gain would be the original number minus this, the original number minus this. So gain will be larger, the smaller this number, the larger the gain. So what I will be looking at in this case is which of these are the smallest numbers. Okay? So this is 1, this is 0, and this one also will be 1. Okay? What possibilities? Oh no, I only gave you these training examples. Okay, so here is an interesting question. Who decides who gets what training examples you get? The teacher. And the teachers can do, you know, whatever. I decided to just have these training examples. So I may have 4, I may have 6. But, you know, you cannot argue with the problem as given. You can't say you should give me more training examples. Given the training examples, you do the best you can. You can't say you should have given me more homeworks, you know, now that the semester is ending. You know, given all the homeworks and the training you got, you still have to do the best. That's how you get decided as to whether or not you're a good learner.
What about the other 4, you know, let's say you got some more later on, would it change your knowledge base? Basically?
Yes. So a learning can be incremental. As the training examples increase, you can keep changing your hypothesis. And the best hypothesis after you know more may be different from the best hypothesis before you knew.
What about interactions? For example, the cases where anxious is false and true is also equivalent, shows up as masochist and nerdy being false and true.
Actually, what is interesting is it's a very beautiful question, except it doesn't happen in this example. It will happen in the example that I make you do in the homework, which is the Seinfeld-Newman party. Okay, so there I set up the example where essentially, so this is a greedy approach, right? And greedy approaches, it should be possible to kill greedy approaches, because the optimal decision tree, if you can find it using greedy approach, then obviously learning should be polynomial. But we know that decision trees represent all Boolean functions, so it should be exponential, because you need exponential examples. So something must give. What gives is the interactions between attributes. Okay? You are deciding that the only questions you ask are single attribute questions. Sometimes the best questions to ask are not single attribute, but pairs of attributes together. So the example, now since I'm not going to, you know, grade that, I will make you do it, but I'll tell you the answer anyway. So I set up the example in the Seinfeld-Newman case where whether it's a successful party or not, and it depends on who showed up for the party. And I made the example such that if Seinfeld and Newman both show up, then it will be a bad party. If one of them show up and the other doesn't, it's okay. But if both show up, it will be a bad party. In that case, the best question to ask is, did both show up? Okay. Now, of course, that is a iceberg, tip of the iceberg. Because if I'm in the business of asking subsets of attributes, there are 2 power n subsets of attributes. So instead of deciding which of the n questions to ask, you are deciding which of the 2 power n questions to ask. So then, yes, it's a greedy in a 2 power n space, which will be optimal. But you die, because you're considering asking all possible subsets of questions together. Okay? So that's exactly the thing that happens in that case. Okay? So if you keep doing these questions for the patterns example, you'll get something like this. Okay? Now, in evaluating decision trees, the interesting part is how do you go about evaluating when you you draw a learning curve? And I never explained last time how learning curves are drawn. Okay. So the idea is, if I give you n examples to begin with, you don't yet know when the testing is actually going to start. Okay. So what you can do is take the n examples, split them into two partitions, the training set and the test set. And then you train the learner on subsets of the training set, and then compute their accuracy on the test set. And so the learning curve here, for example, is showing if I am training my the decision tree on 0 examples, 10 examples, 20 examples, 40 examples, 60 examples, and I'm testing its accuracy on the same test set. Okay? And how the accuracy is changing. In the beginning, its accuracy is quite low, and as the number of examples increase, it very quickly reaches close to 100% accuracy. Okay? The better algorithms reach high accuracy fast with respect to the number of examples. Okay? The faster learner is the one that learns the concept with the fewest examples, and that sort of rhymes well with what we know about teaching and learning, right? Now, one point that you want to understand, another idea that's kind of close to this is, rather than split the current set into just the training part and test part, you can split the current n examples into m equal sized parts. And then say, I would train the algorithm with all but one of the M partitions and test it on the left out partition. And those are basically called M fold cross validation. So you're using the same data that you have been given, which parts are you training on, which parts are you testing on. And having figured it out using this, which is the best learner, best concept you have, then you throw it into the real world. And to the extent the real world examples are drawn with the same distribution as N original N examples, you're going to do well. If not, you die. Can't help it. Okay. Now the other interesting question, of course, is so decision tree seems to be pretty darn good for Russell's domain. Seems to be extremely good for Russell's domain. Okay. Consider now decision tree is actually going to be able to learn every possible Boolean function. Okay, now consider a Boolean function called the majority function. So all that majority function does is, if you have n Boolean attributes, it will be true if the majority of them are true, and false if a majority of them are false. Understood now, right? It's a simple function. So if I have, 20 Boolean attributes, if 17 are true, 3 are false, then the function is true. If 14 are true, 6 are false, then the function is still true, and so on. Okay, if 9 are true and 11 are false, then it's false. Okay, if I consider how the it's clear that the majority function is a Boolean function. So decision trees can be learned to represent majority function. But think about what happens if you write a decision tree for guessing the majority function. How many questions are you likely to have to ask before you figure out what is majority? All n. This is the problem with elections. I mean, what we'd like to do is just hold elections for 10 of us and then decide who the president is. But unfortunately, in the worst case, you have to count everybody's vote before you can decide who won. Okay? So every feature has to be asked. Okay? So what that means is the decision tree is going to be as deep as the number of attributes. And so it actually takes longer to learn it. It also takes longer to converge. So in fact, if you look at how majority function converges, okay, you'll see that it drags on and on and on. You know, as the training size increases, it's not going anywhere close to 90. Okay, this is actually almost more important than what decision trees do, which is any learning algorithm which has a certain bias is going to do well on certain functions that can be easily represented using that bias, and do badly on certain other concepts that can't be as easily represented using that bias. Okay, there is this thing, right, that for a guy with a hammer on in hand, everything looks like a nail. So you kind of, you know, start hitting everybody, everything and everybody. Okay, decision trees try to look at everything in the world as decision trees. There are, what are the best cases for decision trees? Best cases for decision trees are those where you can actually classify the examples with very few questions to begin with. Okay? If the reality was such that in fact you could classify the examples with very few questions, that's where decision tree will win very well. If in the case of majority, that's unfortunately a scenario where decision, you can never ask few questions and get by. So decision tree doesn't do well. Okay? Let me show you that there is somebody else who actually we'll, you know, we'll talk more about next class, who does do quite well on this exact example. If I have the example somewhere. Oh, unfortunately I don't. Let me see. Oh, there you go. Okay. So we will talk about an idea called, instead of decision trees, we will talk about an idea called separation functions. Because the, you know, in the case of, you know, the idea in the separation functions is, since I know that ultimately if I have, let's say, all the examples are represented in terms of two features, F1, F2. Okay, and so, and some are positive and some are negative, then the best way to differentiate them is to actually find a function which separates the positives from negatives, and just remember the equation for that function. And what is the simplest function? A line. Okay, so perceptron essentially, which we'll talk about more next class, tries to find a line, the best line that separates all the positives from all the negatives. And it's like the simplest kind of function learning. Okay, you can also think of this as decision surface, because in multiple dimensions, if you have two dimensions, it's either a line or a curve. If it's three dimensions, what you have is a decision surface. In general, what you have is n dimensions with n different features, okay? And so you have an n-dimensional surface that is separating the positives from the negatives, and you're trying to find its equation. The simplest of those cases is one where that surface happens to be a hyperplane. In two dimensions, hyperplanes are lines, okay? And learning perceptrons is almost mind-numbingly easy. What you do, and we'll talk about it again more in detail next class, is you pick a line, any random line, and then, so as you see the examples, you pick any random line like this, and as you see the examples one by one, if the example is consistent with the line, that is, the line is saying the right thing for that training example, you leave the line alone. If the line is saying the wrong thing with the training example, it is supposed to be positive and the line is saying negative, or vice versa, then you change the slope of the line such that little at a time, such that it will at least be more correct with respect to this example. And if you do this for each example, there is proof showing that you will get to the best line, a line which separates all the positives from all the negatives. Okay. And what's interesting is once you figure out how to run perceptrons, and you know, perceptrons can be run on Russell restaurant data, and this is what they do. What happens is that decision trees are learning very fast. Perceptrons really have hard time learning. Okay? On the other hand, perceptrons are, you know, the one for, let's see, this is not the example here, but you know, on the other hand, if I have a plot showing what happens on the majority function, remember the majority function where the decision tree learner is not doing well, perceptron converges very quickly. because it turns out essentially that the bias that perception has winds is basically whether or not the function is linearly separable, whether or not the training examples are linearly separable. Is there a line that can separate all the positives from negatives? If it is there, then it can find it very fast. Now the problem with the restaurant scenario is that if you write the n-dimensional surface with n-dimensional space with all the positives and negatives, there is no single hyperplane that separates positives from negatives. What you have is like a disconnected, you know, discontinuous pieces of plane. And to do that correctly, in the case of function learning, what you would need is multi-layer perceptrons. That means you have multiple neural nets, multiple threshold units being connected together. And those are much harder to train. Okay? So what this picture is showing is perceptron will never really reach more than about 60% accuracy, how many examples you show. Whereas if you consider multiple layer perceptrons, which are basically the general neural networks, it will go towards 100% accuracy, but it takes time. Okay, and the point I want you to keep in mind as we end the class today is every learner has a bias, ultimately. Biases are needed to reduce the size of the hypothesis space. The question, of course, is whether the bias you have is well connected to the problem that you're trying to learn. Okay, that's a question that I can't answer easily. Okay, I can, however, tell that if, in fact, the problem that you have in front of you has the property that a few of the attributes wind up deciding the label of the problem in terms of positives and negatives, then decision trees are good. If all of the attributes somehow wind up taking part in the decision, then decision trees are not good. But if all the attributes take part in making the decision, but they take part in doing that in a linear way, then perceptrons are good. Okay, so if you are, for example, considering something like spam mail detection, looking at the mail, you decide whether or not it's a spam mail. Okay, in general, things which can combine multiple attributes in, you know, either linearly or non-linearly seem to do much better at spam mail detection than things which assume that there are magic bullets, a couple of, you know, pieces which will tell you whether or not it's a spam mail or not. So decision trees haven't been particularly useful for spam mail detection. Whereas perceptrons, as well as something called naive-based classifiers, which essentially has deep connections to perceptrons at some level, are much better. Okay? And then the reason you do need biases, of course, the one other thing is that in the case of perceptrons, it's like a sliding bias. You can say look for lines first. If that doesn't work, look for like polynomials, quadratic polynomials. If not, look for, you know, higher order polynomials. The problem, of course, is that normally the complexity doesn't jump as easily as you would like it to, continuously as you would like it to. So this picture, actually, which we'll look at again next class, shows that if you only have a single layer of threshold units, all you can learn is lines. The moment you have two layers, you can learn any curve. All that you need is one hidden layer between, so this is single layer because inputs are connected directly to the threshold unit. Okay? Here, inputs are connected through a hidden layer to the threshold unit. The moment you have that, you can learn any function directly. And if you have three layers, then you can learn even a discontinuous function. Okay, what that basically means is it's not all that easy to control the way, and you know that this is much harder because there are many more. The hypothesis space of all curves is obviously much bigger than hypothesis space of all just lines. So unfortunately, there is no easy way of increasing the complexity by just slightly increasing the expressiveness. You say one more layer, all hell breaks loose, and the learning becomes much harder. Okay? There is an interesting idea which tries to use the line separation of perceptrons to find out the curves like this. And that's basically what it does is you split, you throw this data from the two dimensions into larger number of dimensions. Okay, let me show you that picture. It's another 2 minutes, and you're anyway sunk, so 2 more minutes is not going to hurt you, because I may not come back to it next time. Here's a beautiful picture, right? In this case, all the these are all, let's say, positives, these are all negatives. The decision surface for positives and negatives, even in these two dimensions, is a nice little circle. It's not a line, it's a quadratic function. Okay, so no perceptron is ever going to find this line, find this particular thing. Okay, however, suppose I consider these two dimensional data, split it into the right three dimensions, where the dimensions are x1 square here, x2 square here, and square root of 2x1, x2 there. For each two-dimensional data point, there is a three-dimensional data point here. It almost looks stupid. Who would ever take a data which is described in terms of two dimensions and convert it into three dimensions? Okay. But here's the deal. If I do it this way, then clearly there is a plane that separates all the negatives from the positives. So if I do perceptron learning in this space, it will be linear in this space, but the coordinates are quadratic already in the original space. So a line here, I mean a circle here, will become a plane here. What is interesting is that this is not just a made up example. Any example set of training data you can take, you can always blow them up into infinite number of dimensions such that there is a plane that separates the positives from negatives. The question, of course, is which is the right set of dimensions to blow up to, and further, whether you can somehow blow it up and do the learning in one step. And it turns out there is a way, and that's basically kernel-based learning. Okay, and we would again not go into it other than just mention this today. When we come back next class, I will at least tell you the more of the details of the perceptron learning, and then sort of wind up the discussion of learning. And then we'll end. Okay?